There we go. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Jim T, everybody. And I'm so glad to see you out of that hospital, man. Fucking, yeah.
Thanks,
I love you loads.
Mark. And thanks much for inviting me here. It's an honor to be here. See all these smiling faces. It's what keeps me alive. I was born an alcoholic. My first drink was a small glass of beer that was given to me when I was about 6 years old. When people sent out for pizza and beer, I was given a small, and I knew at that time that this was the elixir of the gods. It really, really changed the way I looked at the world for the time that I was under the influence. It was no drinking until I was about 12, and I got drunk and went into a blackout at my sister's wedding. And I woke up that morning afterwards and said, I will never drink again as long as I live. This was repeated thousands and thousands of times. I would wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to stop drinking today and be in a blackout that night. But the preparation for a life of alcoholism and difficulties began a long time before that. My earliest memory is my mother holding my hand. I was about 3 or 4 years old, and we were in Brooklyn, and she was bringing me to a foster home. And when my mom left, I remember I met my foster sisters and brothers and parents, and I can remember this clearly, that I was very, very anxious about that time. And when my mother left without me, I had to be restrained. And that set the tone for feeling that I'm a disposable person. The house that I lived in that house for 11 years, and it didn't go well. When I was six, they brought in a boarder, a man who was a pedophile, and he had sexually abused me from when I was six till I left at 14. The house itself, I never felt I belonged there. And it was, a really stringent Catholic basis. And you didn't talk about sex. Sex was evil. And I knew if I would say anything to my Aunt Mary, who was my foster mom, that I would be in the biggest trouble of my life if I would tell her I was being abused. So I kept this information to myself. There was compensatory situations here. In those days, they didn't have Little League, or they didn't have, parental involvement with every aspect of children. We went out on the street and we played. And the compensatory thing was sports. We played played stickball, football, touch football, baseball, basketball, in addition to stoop ball, box ball, and all these other things, all run by children with a children's culture. And that compensated. I remember thinking that the house where I lived with the foster family, that was in black and white. And when I went out on the street with my friends, that was in Technicolor. So, and I was introduced to a Catholic Church, which, I've had difficulties with. when I first came into the fellowship, I hated all things Catholic. It wasn't until I was sober for about 20 years that I realized that the Catholic Church saved my life. They gave me the Catholic Youth Organization basketball. They gave me Tuesday afternoon movies after school, and provided these things that compensated for the difficulties that I had at home. And I remember I was selective in my hatred for the church. We had a nun in school, Sister, I can't remember her name. I'm having these things. Incidentally, I do have senior moments now where I feel I'm going to say something eloquent, and then I get halfway through a sentence and I forget what I'm saying. So I try to make something up relative to what I was going to say, and it never comes out right. So I'm warning you that that may happen. Sister Frances Stephanie, she was a violent woman who hated children. And she was clear in my memory, things that she did. Now, there was an Irish nun who I don't remember her name, who I completely left out of the picture. The Irish nun gave me a lesson when I was in the fifth grade that really stayed with me after I got sober. She was the victim of the Black and Tans in Ireland in the 1920s. She lived on a farm with her large family, and the Black and Tans invaded her house. They burnt the house to the ground, took the farm animals, and killed her father in the presence of the family. So she spent years in deep hatred for anything English. She eventually got the spiritual life and realized that she had to work on forgiveness and pray for her tormentors, which she did, and she chose a spiritual life and went into the convent. She also said, you know, it's our responsibility to do something when somebody's getting hurt. It's a human responsibility. Now, this lesson I never really gave much credence to. I completely forgot about it. And rather than focus on the Irish nun, I focus on Sister Frances Stephanie. You know, she was gave me a better picture of what happened, that it wasn't until I put the steps in my life that I started to regain some memory of that, and the fact that I believe that the Catholic Church saved my life, because given the situation that I was in that home, I would have really been crazy. Not that I wasn't crazy for many years. So I started to drink heavily when I was about 15. Prior to that, my only escape, my only respite from this was sports. And I loved sports. And then when I was 15, I couldn't play anymore. I couldn't play sports. I was too busy drinking. I drank any time, every time I could. When I was about 17, somebody introduced some white powder into the neighborhood. And I tried it, and I said, you know, this is pretty good stuff. There's no hangover, and you get really nice. This was heroin. And that set me off on a 12-year odyssey, spent getting drugs, buying drugs, and doing illegal stuff to get the drugs, and interspersed by a lot of visits to penitentiaries, institutions, and stuff like that. And I remember when I first started to look at my alcoholism, my thing was, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a dope fiend. And I wound up in 1969. I got arrested as usual. It was, you know, like I made a revolving door between the jailhouse and the street up until then. And I got arrested. And at that time, there was progressive change in the law that they wanted to treat addiction as an illness rather than a criminal offense. So they opened a place called the Narcotic Addiction Control Commission. And instead of going to jail, I went to NAC. And for the first time in many, many years, I met some decent people. And it gave me a sense of hope. Now, they didn't know anything about addiction or alcoholism in those days, even the people that provided treatment for it. So I got a look at the world from a different perspective, but unlike the fellowship, there was no design for living. And so I went away for a year to the Narcotic Addiction Control Commission. And I came out and I was determined that I was going to try to do my best. I left school in the ninth grade. So I needed a high school equivalency, which I had gotten in that program. They gave it to me. And I had a parole officer, a narcotic parole officer, who insisted that I register for courses at the local community college. I was against it. I really didn't think I belonged there. The self-esteem was so low, self-awareness was so non-existent that no way I'm going to go. And this guy, Gene Tice was his name, the PO. He said, no, you're going to school. You're going to school. So I enrolled in Borough Manhattan Community College. And the first half of the semester, I didn't open my mouth. I looked at all these people, these young people, who were all bright, intelligent, and whatnot, and who am I, an old dope fiend who don't know what's going on? So the midterms came up, and I did nothing but I would take verbatim notes in that class, and I studied everything I should have studied. And the midterms came up, I got an A plus on the midterms. Well, the rest of the semester, I didn't shut up. I had opinions on everything. And it shows, you know, I'm either afraid of who I am, or I think I'm better than everybody else. And I want to prove to the world that I'm better than everyone else. This is just some of the dynamics that I go through. Anyway, I got out of school. I graduated. In the last semester, now I haven't had a drink for 3 years. I haven't had a shot of dope for 3 years since I got out of that NAC business. I was under a lot of stress. I was working full time as an assistant counselor, and I was involved in sports and everything, and I felt a lot of stress. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. And I thought, you know, a little shot of whiskey would just calm me down and get rid of the stress. So in between classes, I got a couple of those airplane things of whiskey. And I went into the boys' room and I drank them. And it worked. the stress was gone. But the only thing is, within 30 days, I was drinking a quart of vodka a day. And I just managed to get out of school before the bomb fell out. So here I am, an ex-dope fiend with a bachelor's degree and full of self-importance and everything. I thought that, you know, I knew things that nobody else knew. And I remember I got my first job at a therapeutic community in Harlem. And I lasted 5 days because I drank a quart of vodka, came into work the next morning and attempted to run a group. And in those days, groups were attack groups. And there's nothing greater in an attack group than to attack the group leader. And these guys knew that I was drinking. They knew, even though I had nothing to drink in the morning before the group. And it was one of the most humiliating experiences I ever had. And I got fired and I left there. And the drinking went on, escalating. And I got a job in the methadone program. The methadone program would hire anybody at that time. That's how I got the job. And I remember one day after work, they had a small party and I did my usual drinking and I wasn't completely intoxicated, but I was intoxicated. And I said, this is bullshit. You know, I might as well shoot some dope because the alcohol is really contributing to a lot of dysfunction, couldn't be more than dope. So drunk, I went to Third Avenue to a connection and I purchased a $5 bag of heroin and 2 Valiums. And I went home and ingested that product. I fell out on my left side and stayed that way for 12 hours. I woke up and I was suffering from what's called the crushing syndrome, where all the nerves get crushed in arm and leg. And they had to cut down. It was swelling to such an extent that they had to do a cut down on that, on my left arm and left leg. And I was in the hospital for 4 months with that thing. I didn't learn anything from that. I got out of the hospital, I started to drink again. I wasn't using drugs, but I started to drink again. And I remember I was still working for the methadone program. I don't know what the hell was going on in their heads that they would keep me as an employee, but they did. And I had an apartment and I would work during the day, supposed to be a counselor, but, you know, incapable of relating to other people. I would go to work and then I would get out of work. I would stop at the bodega, buy 2 16-ounce cans of beer, stop at the liquor store, buy a quart of vodka, and go home, and that was it. Prior to that, during the time that I was not drinking, it was the height of the Vietnam War, and I got involved with the peace movement, which was another good thing for me. I met some very nice people who treated me nice, and that was really reinforcing. However, when the drink started in my last year of college, I had to divorce myself from political activity because I was a drunk. So I maintained this existence for a while, going to work most of the time, But I would use up my sick time, personal time, and vacation time by February usually. But it was all hangover time that I was taking off. But I would go home and drink my vodka and pass out, and drink some more vodka and pass out, and drink some more vodka and pass out. And at times be able to get up and go to work. Well, this started, the progression continued with it. And I couldn't do that very well anymore. And eventually I just stopped going to work and stayed in my apartment and drank. I don't know where the money was gonna come for the vodka and everything, but that's the way I was doing it, just laying in bed drinking vodka. My political friends found out about it, and they had the police break down the door, and two very large cops came in, and they found a bottle of vodka under the bed, and they said, "You're gonna have to go for treatment." And they took me to Freeport Hospital, where I got introduced to the fellowship of AA, and came into AA still very crazy. I went into my first meetings, and I felt safe there. First time in a long time, I really felt safe. These bunch of religious fanatics, they were keeping me all right, and this is where I belong. And I couldn't really relate. I couldn't, you know, understand steps or sponsorship or anything like that. I just wanted to hang out with these folks. And that was, I was in Manhattan, and they had a really good community of AA. We used to go to meetings and walk along Broadway and stop in for coffee and then go to another meeting at night. It was really, and I was protected by this environment and I felt safe. Still grandiose and still quite disturbed. I felt that my purpose in sharing at the meeting was to make an impression on people. And I had a sponsor at the time. He said, "You ain't got nothing to say. You have to listen." And for some reason, I started to take him seriously, that maybe he knows something that I don't know. And gradually, I got to a point where I could relate to other people in the fellowship. And the first 4 years, I went out four times for one day. And the last time I drank was 1980. I opened up the refrigerator, and there was a bottle of white wine, half a bottle. And I pulled it out and I drank it, and I got terribly, terribly sick. I got a cast iron stomach, but this half bottle of white wine made me really sick. My wife at the time called everybody she knew in AA. And the last three times I had relapsed, I had the same thing. All these AA folks came over my house and took me to meetings. And my sponsor at the time, he was a sponsor of mine for 30 years, Bill, he came over and said, I want you to come with me to Jersey City. And in Jersey City, a young woman called Bill and said her father is killing himself with alcohol, and he please help. So this is a guy we were going to see, the guy that was killing himself with alcohol. Now, I know it's not a very good practice to do 12-step work when you're counting your sobriety in hours. But I went with him. And we got into his room, and he was laying on the couch in his own filth. We got him cleaned up and took him to a detox facility where they admitted him. And just to backstrap a little bit, when I was 19 years old, I went to my first AA meeting. That was called Addicts Anonymous. This was in Lexington, Kentucky. It was one of the few places that treated addiction. There was a guy there named Coney Allen Max. And Coney Allen Max was an old drug dealer, dope fiend. And I knew him from the street. And this nurse told me Max was walking around with his paper slippers, drool coming out of his mouth, and not very responsive to anything. This nurse told me, she says, "Is that what you want to be when you grow up, when you get older?" And of course, I was 19. I didn't think I'd ever get older. You know, that it was ridiculous, and I paid no attention to it. Now, fast forward to the time Bill McGovern brought me to Jersey City to see this old man. Saw the old man on the couch, and Bill said, "I'm glad you had the opportunity to see yourself as an elderly person." And I said, "Holy shit, that's me laying on the couch. That's me. I could see it." And it was, I forget what you call it, the moment of clarity, yeah. And I haven't had a drink since then. And I still had to grow up. I had, you know, a lot of flaws, character flaws and stuff. And when I was 20 years sober, we had a meeting that went on for, it was Bill, at the time my sponsor, was getting very ill. He was relegated to a wheelchair. So we started a meeting at his house so he wouldn't have to, you know, do all this stuff to get to meetings. And another meeting splintered off a step meeting. So this meeting went on for about 30 years, Saturday and Sunday. Bill, you know, passed, and we continued the meeting. And we were doing a fifth step. And I was determined at that time that I would never, never say anything about being sexually abused. I swore I would take this secret to the grave with me. So in doing this fifth step meeting, I told my friends who I was with that I was sexually abused as a kid. And that really freed me up and allowed me to have some kind of self-awareness, which I never had, and to put the steps really to use rather than just perfunctionary. Senior moments. Started to think, well, you know, I'm not such a bad guy. 20 years sobriety, you know, have to worry about, you know, not being a bad guy, but I'm not such a bad guy. And I put the 11th step to work, and that was, you know, I'm a God seeker, you know, I don't believe in God. And it allowed me to look at other people not as competitors or as somebody that I would have to do better than, but as part of a living substance. After that, my involvement in AA and my working of the steps and everything changed. You know, it was Socrates. It was Socrates quoting Plato. He said that an unexamined life is a life not worth living. He said that 4,000 years ago. And that was really what really the fellowship did for me. It gave me a look at who I am. And I'm not such a bad guy as I always thought I was. Now, when I first went to college, my parole officer had to push me into college. I was in a fellowship. I had about 5 years sober. And my sponsor told me, you got to go to graduate school. I said, I don't belong there. Yeah, you belong there. So I went to graduate school. I got a master's in social work. And then about 5 years later, he said, look, you belong to a union, 1199, a healthcare union, and they pay tuition for a doctoral program. I said, I don't belong in a doctoral program. Yes, you do. So each advance that I had made, it wasn't my decision, it was other people, and it was the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that pushed me further. So I applied for the doctoral program, the PhD program at NYU. And when I got the letter, back, we are pleased to inform you that you have been selected for study at our doctoral program. I looked at that letter and I said, well, are these people crazy? They take dope fans in their doctoral program? How smart can they be? And that was, you know, I'm still struggling with that sense of self looking at myself from a realistic perspective. So I went in the doctoral program and I got a doctorate. And meanwhile, I had gotten married. We had two children who never saw me drink. And unfortunately, I lost one of them 3 years ago. He took his life. And that was the most painful, most difficult thing that I ever went through. I've been through a lot of stuff, you know, from my self-inflicted, mostly going to jail and everything like that, disappointments in life and all that stuff. But losing my Brian, that was something that will never leave me. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in a creator God, but I think there is something to all this stuff, creation, that we're in the dark ages about. And the only thing I can do is try to look and see what's going on here. I gotta say, yeah, remember, I start my day with prayer. The only thing is, it's not a prayer of petition. I don't petition any God to do anything for me. It's a prayer of affirmation. I affirm what I'm going to do. I start off today. I will make an effort to avoid violent thoughts, rage scenarios, moral victories, grandiosity, self-pity, resentment, and self-loathing. Today, I will make an effort to practice kindness, humility, and gratitude. Today, I will honor my beloved Brian. And that's the way I start my day every day. Now, you can call it prayer, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but that helps me see who I am. And naturally, you know, I guess the Catholic repercussions come along. I have pictures of Brian. He was an athlete, a very, very good athlete. And I have pictures of him all over the wall with a candle under that. And when I do my prayer, I light the candle. And I still, you know, I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up, but I'm having some fun trying it. I just got out of the hospital, having the obligatory pneumonia that most 85-year-olds have. I'm 86, and every couple of years I get a pneumonia and I wind up in the hospital. But I still, you know, since I got sober, I've been training and working out, and I still work out every day, not as much as I did, you know, 40 years ago. But I ran a few marathons, and I have a beautiful, beautiful grandchild. And I just saw him, you know, yesterday, and his little league team, he got a hit and scored a run. And I was just as proud as I could possibly be. And this is the essence of joy that I have, that I am devastated by the loss of my Brian. But there is still, you folks taught me that there is still joy in life. And I have to cling on to that. I guess, you know, I don't know. Mark said I can speak for an hour. I don't know if I got an hour. And, you know, I see a lot of nice faces here. And, you know, if it's early, we can continue. But that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.